Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media, and you can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that occurs in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I'm doing great also. Well, I need to get an update from you. Have you seen any of the summer blockbusters yet? Have you seen the ones that we were kind of looking forward to? Yeah.
Well, you know, we talked about three movies, and I can tell you that I've seen two of the three we talked about. I've seen 42.
Okay.
And spoiler alert, everyone, the Brooklyn Dodgers actually get the pennant in 1947. So sorry to blow that for anybody. And I've seen Star Trek Into Darkness. Actually put a rather controversial thing up on Facebook about that the other day. Still not up to speed on Iron Man, but hopefully we can do our summer movie show here in a few weeks. How about you? Are you're back ahead of me, or what's the latest?
I guess that, you know, you're actually ahead of me because I've not seen 42. And it is one that I would like to see. So.
Well, then we're tied because you've seen Iron Man.
That's right.
And I have. So, yeah, we're in the same position. All right. So you know, tracking with the big summer blockbusters. Obviously, Man of Steel coming.
Just a few weeks.
A couple weeks.
Like 2 or 3 weeks from now. I'm not sure.
June 15th, I believe, is the big day.
Yeah, so but we really do. Once a year, we do our summer blockbusters show where we just cover them all, and we have a good time with that. That's fun.
We got to do that. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll make sure we get the release dates for all of them. So we'll have it after they've all been released, so we can let people know how they're supposed to feel about all these
conversation movies. about the movies. That's great.
Exactly. All right. Well, that's not tonight. Tonight we've got a terrific new guest who's not been with us before, and a really fun topic. One of the topics that we touch upon from time to time, but I'm not sure that we've done a show dedicated just to this outside of the special series, the special World Transform series we did a few years ago when we talked about this. Don't think we've touched it since then. So we're a couple years maybe overdue to be talking about this, don't you think?
Yeah, and like you say, we hit on some related concepts on a fairly regular basis, but this is just a little bit different, and I'm glad we got someone on the show that can really get into this with us.
Get us going on this. All right. Well, let me bring out our guest. Our guest is named Aurelian Solaris Carpathia. He's a well-known member of the online transhumanist community, an administrator over at the Singularity Network, and about a week and a half ago, maybe about 3 weeks ago, he published a truly thought-provoking essay on Facebook on the subject of simuality, which is what we're going to be discussing this evening. And I've posted his essay. He was kind enough to allow us to post the essay over on worldtransform.com. So if you look at the show announcement for tonight's show, you can get caught up on that in case you missed it on Facebook. And Aurelien, welcome to the World Transformed.
Greetings. Glad to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you with us this evening and eager to get into the topic of simuality. I think before we delve into all the implications and the deeper meaning of simuality, let's get the basic meaning of it. Can you tell us in a few words what the essay is about and what the basic concept is?
Yes. Simuality is a contraction of simulated reality, which is distinguished from virtual reality, which is VR being the traditional experience of a head-mounted display and perhaps an omnidirectional treadmill, something which has varying degrees of sophistication but never quite reaches the replication of reality, which you see in simulated reality. And whereas virtual reality is existent in the present, simuality is, for now, in the foreseeable future, strictly theoretical. But there are researchers such as Miguel Nicolelis at Duke and Kevin Warwick at the University of Reading who are working towards that. So basically, simuality is the idea that we can recreate reality perfectly because we are machines, basically. We take in sensory data and we respond to that data by sending neural impulses back down from our brain out to our body, and that creates our experience of reality. So currently, in order to have interesting experiences, we need to arrange atoms in interesting ways, and that is the root cause of all scarcity and, I think, of most conflict. You want a nice car, you want a mansion, you want a vacation home, you want all these things, and they all require that atoms be arranged in certain ways. And there's a scarcity of atoms, and certain structures of atoms, certain patterns are more expensive than others because they're more difficult to create. But ultimately, you're just taking in sensory data, so the atoms are reduced to neuroelectrical impulses. So what if you could just bypass the atoms altogether and just have the neuroelectrical impulses, and then virtually anything could be free? So, and for every person who could jack into the matrix.
So it's, you know,
I was about to ask. If you foresee this more like the Matrix or the holodeck on Star Trek. I mean, which you just answered the question.
Well, definitely.
So more like a little bit more like the Matrix, because you would not have to have this big room. You would be kind of jacking into it, right?
Exactly. Holodeck is actually a distinct concept called synthetic reality, which is distinct from both simulated and virtual reality. Synthetic reality is like Claytronics or utility fog, which Dr. John Storrs Hall, I believe, coined. The idea that we can create these nanites, which can form into virtually any state of classical matter, solid, liquid, gas, other than food, within our own physical reality. So it's a sort of virtual or simulated reality which exists in the real world, but that would be even more difficult to create than simulated reality and would have some limitations. So there's VR and then simuality and then synthetic reality. So definitely the Matrix for simulated reality.
Okay.
But if you look at it from a purely economic standpoint, from a purely bang for your buck standpoint, simuality tops everything, right? Because when you look at something like the holodeck, I've never quite known for sure how that was working, but presumably they're still pushing atoms around somehow or other, right? They're like replicating matter on the fly, or I've never been completely sure how the holodeck works.
Yeah,
but certainly
within the lore of the Star Trek universe, they are converting energy directly into matter and then mixing that with holograms, so a completely infeasible solution. But the real-world solution to the holodeck would be utility fog, which is still very speculative, even more so than simuality. Better to just create neural interfaces.
speculative, but assuming utility fog works, it would still be a greater cost to implement, right?
Exactly.
I mean, in terms of the amount of matter you got to push around, the amount of energy you have to expend. What's interesting in your essay to me, in addition to the basic concept, which I think is a fascinating idea, is the notion that through this we achieve true post-scarcity. We can completely eliminate scarcity, as you said, as long as you have a computer that can create the proper signals into your brain. You can have anything, you can do anything, you can go anywhere, you can be anything, because what's really occurring for that subjective experience is just whatever those proper signals are, the corresponding signals to create those experiences. And that is a fairly, you know, what's the terminology here, fairly low energy task once you've cracked that code, once you can speak that language.
Absolutely.
So one of the swinging it back just to the Matrix idea, I should probably explain the name of the show, which I didn't mention. We're calling the show tonight Red Pill or Blue, which is the choice that Morpheus offers Neo in the Matrix. For those of you familiar with the Matrix, and in that instance, Morpheus is talking to someone who's living in Simuality and giving him the opportunity to come out of it, to experience the real world, which has been hidden from him up to this point. And I'm actually turning that around tonight, and we're gonna confront the question of, I guess it's more properly blue pill or red. If given the choice between living here in real reality and moving into Simuality, which would you pick individually, listeners? Be thinking about that. And which will the world ultimately pick? And that's kind of the direction that I want to take this. But one of the things, Aurelian, that really struck me as I was reading your essay was the idea that if we made a permanent move into Simuality, and we'll get into when that occurs in the timeline here in a minute, but if that were to happen, you could fit the whole population of the world, I guess, basically in a big vat, right, a big body farm in the state of Texas. Right, Texas could contain the whole population of the Earth, and then the whole rest of the Earth could become just a big park or a big game preserve or a big, protected wilderness, because we'd all be experiencing nature inside Simuality instead.
Yes, actually, Marshall Brain, the founder of HowStuffWorks.com, wrote an essay entitled "The Day You Discard Your Body" on his website, available for free to read, in which he imagines a future of what he calls brain storage facilities. He has this concept called the vertebrain, as in vertebra and, I guess, brain, that is inserted into the top of the spinal column and creates a pass-through port to enable access to the Matrix. And he thinks that will appear, I think, sometime in the late 21st century. In that will be the first step. We'll just have this jack or some other perhaps less invasive way of accessing the Matrix without leaving our bodies. And that will gradually evolve into, as we continue to replace more and more of our organs and limbs with bionic alternatives, which are equal or superior to the natural biological examples, eventually we'll just decide, why don't we just transition out of the body altogether, store the brain in a secure facility, and then interact with both Simuality and also reality by telerobotics. You can have your brain signals on wires, as Kevin Warwick says, and send them out into the world using androids or other forms to interact with reality. And so that would eliminate accident. And I think that's something that transhumanists and life extensionists should discuss more often, because, as Aubrey de Grey says, yes, we could live to 1,000 in our biological bodies, not dying of aging, but there would still be accidents. And actually, if you're living to 1,000 rather than 100 or 60, the chance of dying in an accident is obviously much greater. So that'll be a serious consideration. I'm sure we'll want to store the most precious aspect of our bodies, the brain, in a secure facility and then just go elsewhere through teleporting our brain signals.
Yeah, we've talked about with Aubrey and others about what happens when you eliminate aging and you eliminate disease. What happens to the human lifespan? Contrary to popular wish, it doesn't at that point become permanent. It doesn't become indefinite. What did Aubrey say about 800 years? Is that right? The actuarial tables tell us if all else fails, there's a bus with your name on it that will hit you eventually in a matter of centuries.
I think it's closer to 1,000. The number it kept coming out with was very close to 1,000. I think so. People tend to round to 1,000. When talking about that, if you don't die of aging or age-related things, then the bus will get you. It might get you at age 500 or it might get you at age 1500, but on average, people would live to be about 1,000 years old.
You get about 1,000 years out of the deal. On the other hand, if you're locked away someplace in a secure bunker, still having all kinds of incredible subjective experiences of freedom and beauty and all the good stuff that we want life to include, but your body Aurelian, as you were saying, maybe just your brain tucked away someplace very well protected, that period of time can be increased significantly. Also, it's interesting.
Can I jump in, Bill, and just say you made the distinction just a little bit earlier between the real world and the subjective world or whatever. Actually, I don't see this so much like a virtual reality just a different way of interacting potentially with this reality. Aurelian, do you see it's just sort of a mixed world of the best possible experiences in virtual reality mixed with being able to interact in totally different ways with this world, mixed it together, or do you think people tend to choose to go all virtual where they're not in this world at all? Or how do you see how that would work out?
Well, certainly I think the majority of people will interact with both. As I mentioned, teleoperation or telerobotics, channeling our brain signals along communications lines and systems and subjectively inhabiting remote androids anywhere on Earth will be able to truly teleport ourselves. In a way, we're teleporting now. We're teleporting our voices. And with more sophisticated systems, we can teleport our voices as well as our visages. And with virtual reality technologies like the Oculus Rift, which is developed by Palmer Luckey and has become very famous after the Kickstarter campaign, combined with the omnidirectional treadmill from Virtuix, in, say, 2014, you'll be able to, for less than $1,000, be able to strap on the glasses, step onto the Virtuix Omnitread, and walk around. And so that'll be a form of teleportation. And we're just continuing to improve the fidelity of the experience, with simuality being the ultimate end of that. So we'll just be able to go over to Japan or Amsterdam or Kuala Lumpur, wherever we want to go, without any kind of resource expenditure. Just think and you're there. So it'll be the real world. And as I mentioned in the essay, we'll be able to go anywhere on Earth, but beyond translunar space, at least, all bets are off. Then if you want to go to Mars, then you need to, actually travel there. But Kevin Warrick has noted that you can just stay in orbit above Mars and then send your signals down to the surface. So it might be that we never need to go down to the surfaces of planets ourselves, spending all these resources and taking these risks going in and out of the gravity wells. Why not just remain in orbit and then send your signals down and have a rover on the ground which you're inhabiting and experiencing?
So let's back it up just a little, because I want to get to space exploration in a few minutes. I think that's a really interesting aspect of what you wrote. But let's talk a little bit about how we would get there from here. And I was jotting some notes down this afternoon, thinking about how we might come to live in a world such as you're describing here, and it seems to me that there are maybe three stages of working towards true simuality. Initially, we might have a much richer virtual reality than we currently have, bordering on the full immersion variety that that Ray Kurzweil talks about, that pushes us in the direction of simuality, but still isn't there either in terms of subjectively what you're experiencing.
Have you seen the Oculus Rift and Virtual Xomni?
I've not, no.
Oh, you definitely look those up. The Oculus Rift head-mounted display, which was developed on the Meant to Be Seen 3D forum, the virtual reality sub-forum, and became a popular product on Kickstarter and was picked up by the media. It's the first head-mounted display with a panoramic field of view, high resolution, and stereoscopic imagery under $1,000. It's supposed to cost $300 or $400. And combining that with the Virtuix Omni, which is a passive omnidirectional treadmill, which you can fit almost in the closet, that's basically it, the virtual reality, which Kurzweil speaks of. And that's supposed to be available next year.
Well, except do you get the haptic experience from that? Is there a tactile aspect to that, or is it? It sounds like it's visual and motion, but not yet the other senses. Is that correct, or am I?
Yes, that's essentially correct. The Rift plus Omni combination is just visuals and motion.
Obviously, you get sound. Yeah, but
right, and well, you would attach a surround sound headset for sound, and then for tactile feedback, there are a few solutions such as the ForceTech Vest, which is a pneumatic vest which can deliver these shocks of air, compressed air, to simulate impacts, and also the Novent XIO or XIO arm, but those are just prototypes which have no or limited release. So the potential for haptics already exists. We've had it for some years. The technical capability is there, but the commercial aspect isn't.
Right. And so we'll hit, I think we'll hit a wall there. I think virtual reality will probably get about as good as it can get. And at some point, we will begin to see some level of implementation of simuality, at least the approach you're talking about, which is feeding signals directly into the brain, and I think that becomes very compelling from a business standpoint. That there's a market for that as soon as you can offer a full immersion subjective experience. It would not be something you would move into. You don't go live in simuality at that point. It would be something that people would go do kind of in the way of now I can't think of it. The movie where they go to Mars, but they don't. You're never really sure if they went. Total Recall. Like Total Recall, where you would go in temporarily, have an experience, and then come back out. And that would move in the direction of permanent simuality. Because there's another problem that has to be solved before you get to permanent simuality, which is mentioned by our friend Ken in the chat room, who says, "What if I get hungry?" Right. In addition to solving the problem of feeding signals into the brain, there has to be a really sophisticated system for taking care of a human body, which is otherwise being completely, unattended. You're not doing anything with your body. You're not feeding it. You're not sleeping. You're not doing any of the normal things that you do to take care of yourself, because you're having this completely separate experience. So there's actually two major technological hurdles that have to be overcome in order to make that happen, aren't there?
That's an excellent point. I think that once we can completely replicate reality in a simulated environment, I think we'll also have, along with that, the ability to put the body on autopilot. So you have to pass through port, sending your signals into the computer, and then you have your body, which your brain is, your conscious perception is disconnected from, and I think just send some simple signals, tell it to run on the treadmill and feed itself, wash itself. I think that should be possible.
Yeah, in fact, I think those two technologies would be very close to one another. If signals go one way, they can go the other, right?
Absolutely, yes, bidirectional interface.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is subjective versus objective time that we're talking about here. You could perhaps have a week's worth of experiences in a single day, and you know, come out, take care of yourself, and then go back in and have another week's worth the following day.
Yes, that's an area in which I haven't done hardly any research on. I'm not sure how subjective time would be handled, but yes, that is certainly an intriguing possibility.
If that is a possible application of this, that would be another reason people would want to do it, right? say a day in Simuality would take 2 hours in of real clock time. You could go in there and suddenly your life is 12 times longer, right? It would be a subjective approach to life extension. You get a longer life out of the fact that you've changed the clock speed you're operating at. Of course, if everyone else is still operating at this speed, you've got a major disconnect going on. But you know, there's always going to be little problems like that when you start messing around with clock speed. Now, when people actually do start to make this permanent move, if this occurs, and you reach a point where it's maybe not just a matter of sending signals to your brain and telling it to eat, but your body gets put kind of stored someplace permanently, and eventually, as you mentioned, it might not even be the whole body; it might just be the brain, which to me really feels like a commitment. At that point, you're saying, "Yeah, I've." Really decided on the Simuality lifestyle. Once you lose the body altogether, but in that vein, one of the things you wrote that really got my attention was you said that the competition will still exist among those few who wish to see the stars, the real stars, because as you mentioned, you can't teleport. You could teleport to fake other planets, you know, to made up places, but you couldn't actually teleport to another planet. If we send a probe to Mars, there's going to be a huge time lag to make it possible for you to have that experience. You'd actually need to take your stored body or your stored brain or whatever it is and move it out into space in order to have that experience. But I think that is the way it would work, isn't it? Even in the instance of space exploration, even if we were to build starships and people were to take off on these very long journeys, they wouldn't leave Simuality, right? They would still be in it, in the spaceship, and they'd have their stored bodies on the rocket with them, but probably continue to enjoy, you know, a much wider set of experiences than you could possibly otherwise have on a spaceship.
Yes. Well, firstly, you mentioned the commitment of choosing to isolate your brain. Consider that you'll have the choice of re-sleeving, of course, as Takeshi Kovacs does in Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan. You can, in principle, just remove your brain and transmit it, or rather place it into another body, perhaps a superior android body, or as is also done in the Japanese anime Ghost in the Shell. But regarding space travel, yes, we can teleport anywhere on Earth, but the signal delay between planets is too immense. The moon is about 2.5 light seconds round trip from Earth, so you could sort of go back and forth. You could have conversations, and indeed, the president called the moon once when the astronauts landed, but it would be very laggy for a simulated reality experience, and certainly beyond translunar space. Out in translunar space, you would have no capability. So you go to Mars and Venus and Jupiter, and you really have to go to those places. But yes, the people would remain in the simulated environments. That's actually the plot of Ronald D. Moore, who wrote for Star Trek and created the new Battlestar Galactica, and Michael Taylor's Virtuality, which was a 2009 science fiction pilot on the Fox network, which was not picked up, but the idea is that this starship, the first launched by Earth on a 10-year journey to explore Epsilon Eridani, they live in virtual reality, or rather simulated reality more properly, while they're on board the ships, they don't have any problems with space and resources and tension. Although in the story, that doesn't work out, and the strange man appears and starts somehow killing them in the simulated environment for real. But that's beside the point.
Sounds cool. I would think that's
the enabling technology, isn't it? That's in so many science fiction movies, they have someone in deep sleep or whatever. I think simulated reality works even better for that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, the one difference being this has been kind of tossed around as this is what you do to kill time while you get there. But the thought was always, once you get there, then you're going to climb out of the thing and you quit having the dream and put on your spacesuit and go live on the planet. But I really don't think that would happen, right? I think you would stay in. You would stay in virtuality no matter what. You would go experience that planet, but probably through a robot body or something like that. It seems to me that you kind of cross this threshold where there's not a big advantage to going back to living the way we do. But we're going to get into some of that philosophical stuff in a few minutes. Before we do, I wanted to talk a little bit about the post-scarcity aspect of it, because I think this is really interesting. We touched on it earlier when I mentioned the economic argument for simuality over other ways of achieving this kind of experience. But it seems to me that there's a good case to be made that simuality also is the best way to achieve post-scarcity. We're going to be next week. Steve and I are going to be talking about Eric Drexler's new book, Radical Abundance, and we're going to be talking about nanotechnology and how it holds the promise of making material goods much more abundantly available and eliminating poverty and solving a lot of the world's problems. But I don't think nanotechnology on its best day can hold a candle to this idea, can it? Here you can make anything happen, right? Anybody can have truly anything they want, and they can experience it just as though it was really happening.
Yes. Well, to briefly return to your last point before that regarding science fiction and returning to the spacesuit, science fiction presents all these technologies such as teleportation and the simulated reality and faster-than-light travel and anti-gravity, but they're used as plot devices. So they have these fantastically advanced technologies which are never exploited due to the lack of imagination of the viewing public and the writers, I suppose. But yes, the idea of nanotechnology is definitely not as advanced as simulated reality. I mean, it's actually a more advanced technology, but it has, I think, less potential. You can create the utility fog, maybe, if nanotechnology works. There's a lot of controversy over Drexler's theories. I'm not a nanotechnologist. I actually don't have any formal scientific training, but I know that for decades, Drexler has been criticized. On my wall, Mark Plus will often comment on that, how he doesn't think Drexler is being realistic at all. But I don't think it matters, because we have this highly theoretical technology of creating all these nanites that are swarming around the Earth, or we can just keep developing something that already exists, because neural interfaces already exist. Apparently they first appeared in the early 1970s at UCLA, and the research accelerated in the mid-1990s with companies like BrainGate and researchers like Nicol Ellis and Warwick. We have the ability now to connect two humans together, their nervous systems, as Warwick did with his wife, or to send our signals from our minds across the internet, as Warwick also did about 10 years ago. And right now we're using neural interfaces experimentally and therapeutically. We can use them to cure Parkinson's or Tourette's, but in the future we'll be using them for augmentation. As Kevin Warwick said, eventually we won't just be restoring functions that people have lost. We'll be giving people functions that they've never had, like Nicol Ellis allowing mice to sense infrared.
I think
that's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really amazing when you think about it. Think about seeing X-rays and some of those examples you gave in the essay, hearing ultrasonic sounds. I guess we could all get night vision too, right? Any manner of senses that we don't currently have, if the information could be fed directly into our brain.
Like Riddick.
Exactly.
Like Riddick.
Yeah. But swinging it back around to the notion of post-scarcity, first off, I think that I don't want to get into next week's show, but personally believe that that some of the skeptics are wrong about Drexler, and that they're actually making a mistake on the S curve of technology. We're getting it wrong the second time. First we were too enthusiastic, and now we're too skeptical about nanotech. But I actually see it as potentially one of the great enablers of the world you're talking about, because it seems to me if we're going to have things like really resilient, long-term, durable storage facilities for bodies, or really effective Android bodies that we could go into that far surpass what human bodies could do. Nanotechnology would be the ideal technology to provide all those. What we don't need it for is the post-scarcity piece of it. As you pointed out, in our world today, in order to have a subjective experience, you got to move all these atoms around. Well, what nanotech does is it makes you a lot better at that, right? So suddenly you can move atoms around much more efficiently than you could before, and we'll end up with a lot more atoms being moved around. But perhaps not. That's not the most efficient way to get to get to where we're going. So it seems to me that that simuality is probably step two on the path to step three, which is the ultimate savings, the ultimate efficient way to do this, which is absolute uploading, right? When you get
uploading.
Yeah, if you get the human body out of the equation altogether, then that's like one last bit of efficiency that you can add to the process.
Yes, mind uploading, or as Randall Kona prefers, achieving substrate-independent minds, is certainly the ultimate end. That's beyond transhuman, moving into the post-human. And I certainly want to see that. I asked Randall at Alcor 40 when he thought uploading might be achieved. He said, maybe 2045, but don't hold me to that. That's just a ballpark guess since you asked for one. But he said, we really don't know. We can't be certain. And I am not an expert in mind uploading at all. I can't say when that will happen, and I also don't know much about nanotechnology, but I definitely see them as far more speculative than neural interfaces, because neural interfaces have very tangible applications now, and it's just a matter of continuing to evolve them. People think of the Matrix as this magical technology, which is completely impossible or highly speculative, but it's really not. It's really just rerouting the neural impulses. It's very simple. And yeah, you're absolutely right. The nanotechnology is moving the atoms around a lot better, but why don't we just do away with the atoms entirely?
Yeah, save the energy for more productive tasks that we can perform. This gets us into ultimately long term, when we've gone into simuality or uploaded, and it's been a billion years or so, we run into these, we talked about this a few weeks ago, Stephen, these Malthusian limits, ultimately, for what humanity can achieve across the entire universe. And getting to the most efficient state is one of the things that helps us address those in the long term. So the sooner we actually get to the most efficient state that we can get, I think the better off we are. Speaking as a long view kind of transhumanist here, looking forward to that post-human era. Now,
yeah, I think we should ask the viewers whether they would step through the Star Trek transporter, because that's what I always ask when I'm talking about mind uploading. Would you step through the Star Trek transporter or not? Because I say yes, I would, because I'm a pattern identist. I think my atoms are irrelevant. As we learned in the 1950s, the body replaces 98% of its atoms every year. So clearly, we're not our individual atoms. We're not our specific atoms. We are patterns which require atoms, but just any atoms for form. So you can deconstruct yourself, transmit yourself across the universe, and be reconstituted. But apparently many people have a conceptual block over that. They see it as destroying or killing the original, but I don't think that way.
You know, we throw this one out, Stephen, what is it, at least twice a year, right? Would you get in the transporter? And I'm going to give it to you because I think I know your answer. Has Aurelian persuaded you? Now you're ready to go, yes?
Well, you know what? Aurelian, guess first is what I...
a bit of a pause there.
I'm going to be a good host and
the guests go first.
You know, you try it first. And I want to make sure that the Aurelian
okay.
that comes back is not a zombie in any way, but is as convincing as the Aurelian who left. And then I jump in.
Getting into the philosophical question of the pea zombie. How do we know that I'm still conscious? I mean, you could be a perfect copy to someone else. You could seem to be completely the same but not actually be conscious. I'm not saying that teleportation would destroy your consciousness, but people would make that argument.
They might. Well, we had the Hard Problem of Consciousness show a couple weeks ago with Ben Gertzel and David Pierce, and those guys did not, as they promised they would at the beginning of the show, completely solve all those issues. So I'm still a little miffed at them for that.
Those questions remain. Yeah.
those questions do remain. But actually, Stephen, I'm surprised to hear you say that. I didn't know you had made the leap to patternist. I'm still kind of I'm pretty much a patternist, but I've got this kind of continuity issue that I feel like I'm a pattern that has a time element. I'm a pattern that is in motion. If you completely stop it and restart it, I'm not sure that's still exactly the same pattern. But
so that is the other of the two major complaints people have, objections people have toward mind uploading. And to that, I always cite Ken Haworth of the Brain Preservation Foundation's essay, Killed by Bad Philosophy, in which he discusses a real, fairly routine surgery, which has been in use for half a century, called PHCA, in which the brain is essentially taken offline for up to an hour without oxygen, without any brain activity for up to an hour, and then the surgery is completed and function is restored. So the continuity of consciousness is undoubtedly lost there and then restored.
Yeah, and I hope that doesn't happen to me, because I'm not sure if it does. When I wake up after that hour, I'm still the same person. There you go.
I don't understand that question. Just I ask people that, and then they say, well, I'm not sure it would be me, but why not? Why wouldn't it be you?
Well, I'll tell you what. We're not doing a show on uploading. We could work on objections to uploading, but we've got to talk about the objections to simuality. Let's get into those. I think those will be more
right.
Because we've spent hours on those anyway. And promises to resolve those things are never delivered on. It's the saddest thing. So here we go.
That's what's good about simuality, isn't it? That it doesn't really raise any philosophical questions, and it's not so maddeningly theoretical.
You know, it raises some subtle ones, and let's get into those. Okay, here's the first one. I think this one is dispatched easily. Okay, but I'm going to take the buzzkill, worried person here, and give you the arguments, Aurelian, and then you set me straight. Okay, objection number one: it won't really be as good as the real world. I don't want to do it because I like the real world, and that won't be as good. It'll be a fake. That's objection number one.
If you take that view, then you can ruin it for yourself. But empirically speaking, as I've noted, the experience of reality is entirely subjective anyway. I mean, not entirely subjective, I shouldn't say that, but it is just the result of input and output. You have electrochemical impulses coming into the brain and then going out, and that is the sum total of our experience of reality. That's how we interact with the world, and that can be recreated in a computer with the same impulses, because with mind uploading, you are completely changing what you are. You are transferring your pattern onto an entirely different substrate. But with simulated reality, you're not changing the brain at all. There's no change to the brain. The same impulses go in and out, exact same. In fact, the brain has no idea whether simulated reality is active or not. the only way you would know is if you see people jumping 50 feet in the air or anti-gravity generators or whatever. But it's the same exact experience, scientifically speaking.
Okay. How about this? And this is, I think, closely related, but it has a slightly different flavor of an objection. Keep in mind, I'm not saying I hold to these objections. I'm just I'm giving the ones that I anticipate others will give.
Sure.
It's wrong somehow to leave the real world behind. This is where we belong. This is the world we belong to, and we shouldn't just turn our back on it.
Well, I don't even consider that a legitimate argument. I've been raised in an environment where lots of things are wrong. Being gay is wrong. Watching R-rated movies is wrong. Everything is wrong, according to someone. So what is wrong? I mean, what is good? What is evil? Now we're just getting into philosophy 101. I don't see how anything could be considered wrong, which falls outside the harm principle of John Stuart Mill. You don't hurt people. And beyond that, just, you know, do whatever you want. Simulated reality, we can say with certitude, would dramatically increase everyone's lives. So I don't see how that could be called wrong. The only legitimate complaint in that vein, I think, is the security concerns, which is an extremely valid complaint. But just the notion of leaving reality, I don't see how that can be classified as wrong, whatever wrong means.
Well, I threw that word out there.
Can I jump in real quick and toss my two cents in on that?
Go, Stephen. What do you got? don't jump on my next objection, though.
Time,
if you jump on my next objection, I'm going to be upset. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my apologies. Phil, repeat the question one more time. I'm jumping in and then forgetting my point. My apologies.
No, I'm sorry. Is it wrong somehow in some sense? And the other word I was about to say was, it's not natural, right? We're violating nature somehow to.
Right, so that's just an appeal to nature.
It's maybe related to the old joke, Phil, that, you know, the last invention that we ever make is like the holodeck, and we're all living in, you know, our own private harems or something, and not engaged at all in this world. I think there's a fair chance that this sort of technology is an enabling technology that allows us to engage more in this world.
I completely agree.
We engage more in this world. We do more good and valuable things in this world while at the same time, experience this incredible life. Also, I don't think it takes anything away. It improves our ability to do things.
Well, okay. Now I'm gonna take one more shot here, and this is the one that I almost sort of can see the argument. Okay. And I'll elucidate after I give you guys both a chance to respond. This is the big one. Life in simuality will ultimately be boring or unsatisfying. That ultimately we'll see through it and we won't like it.
I think that's no different from the argument against curing aging. People will eat healthily, exercise, go to the doctor regularly. But then when we talk about curing aging, they say, oh, no, that'll be boring. Well, why aren't you dying at 40? Why are you living to 80? And was Jean Calment bored with her 123 years of life? No. Is Jiramon Kimura, who is still alive at 116, the oldest man in recorded history, is he bored with life? No, he's not. He enjoys his life. And there was a Japanese supercentenarian who died a few years ago named Tomoji Tanabe. And when he was 112, he was asked by a reporter, how long do you want to live? And he said, infinity. And I think the same is true of simulated reality. People don't like to imagine that something better is in store for future generations. So they can't have it, so they rationalize it as undesirable.
Well, I think there might be something there. But let me give you a hypothetical. A friend invites you over to their home for breakfast one fine morning. And you're having breakfast, and she tells you, you know, I've really got my garden exactly the way I like it. You should go out and take a look. And so you step out the back door, and this garden is just beautiful. It's early morning light. There's dew. The birds are singing. The fragrance of the flowers is intoxicating, and you just enjoy this stroll through the flowers, through the garden so much. You come back in, you sit down to finish your breakfast, and you say, that's absolutely beautiful. That's the most beautiful garden I've ever seen. And she tells you, yeah, actually, you know what? The whole thing's fake. Look, that's not even the sun. That's a fake picture of the sun. These are plastic flowers. I was squirting perfume into your face, and the experience you just had wasn't really what you thought you were having. Would you be irritated with your friend? Would you think, wow, she's clever? What's your feeling about that garden before and after she reveals that she's faked you out with it?
Since I don't have that irrational bias, I don't think that the word fake means anything. To say that a simulated reality is fake is a meaningless statement to me. I don't think that there's any difference, because there isn't any difference, neurochemically speaking, between simulated reality and reality. It's just the signals going in and out. Why do you need the atoms? So, no, I wouldn't be irritated at all.
Steven?
Phil, let me just answer that by saying, Phil, you've had the experience, like many of us have, of just disappearing, losing yourself into a book, okay?
Yes.
Picking up an awesome book like To Kill a Mockingbird, and just falling into that world so much that when you finally put the book down, you go, wow, that was an experience reading that book. Are you irritated with Harper Lee that she created something that was fake? No.
I got to tell you, I've had a problem with her for a long time. And
yeah.
Another book.
No, but she wasn't trying to fake me out like my friend in the garden was, right? She,
oh, okay,
you know, she,
okay.
She told,
well,
I walked back in and she said, hey, Paul,
if similarity is boring or not as good as the real world, then we're not doing it right yet. And no one's holding you at gunpoint, forcing you into similarity. If the technology
simuality
is just sort of
simuality
halfway there, then you keep tweaking it and working on it until you do get it there.
Okay, well, what I'm nudging around here is this is the Star Trek Generations argument, right? If you've seen that movie, everybody gets pulled into this nexus where they can have everything they want and they can experience anything that they've always, their deepest, most cherished dreams come true. And you know, Picard, it's not good enough for him, right? It's like, well, this isn't real, and therefore I can't stand it. I got to get back to the real world and solve problems there that my crew's not competent enough to solve. I have to go solve. And what does he do? He pulls poor Kirk out and persuades him of the same thing, right? But there's this interesting scene where Kirk is on a horse and he's jumping over this ravine with a horse, and he says, you know, I was always scared whenever I did that, but I've just done it four times and I didn't feel anything. A capriciousness and a real danger to the real world that ultimately would be lost? And would that be something that we would be the worse for?
Well, we continue to reduce risk in every conceivable way. We like to watch violent movies and play violent video games and experience risk and violence vicariously, but we don't see many people who are of sound mind, as typically judged, going off and just disregarding their safety for no reason. I mean, you might be lazy and not wear a seatbelt and then die in a car crash, but you're not going to just walk around with firecrackers in your hair for no reason. So, no, I don't think that we really will lose anything by virtually eliminating risk. I think we'll just continue to have our vicarious experiences of combat and warfare for fun, and we could even create simulations where we temporarily forget that we're in the simulation, and so we could experience an extremely harrowing, realistic representation.
See, that was the only part of that third one that seemed a little bit legit, because I got thinking, would rock climbing be any fun in simuality? You know, it's like, if you don't have that slight, I might die doing this, you know, not that I'm a big rock climber to begin with, but I'm just thinking in terms, I do mountain biking, and there's a little bit of that there too. If there's not the risk, you know, some of the, it seems some of the fun gets put out. But you make a good point, which is that you might dampen your memory of the fact that that it's risk-free. You might actually be able to fiddle with those controls when you wanted to. And then the beautiful thing is take all the risk away whenever you don't want it, which is most of the time in life. Let's face it, most of the time we're not jumping ravines or climbing, doing rock climbing or putting ourselves in these harrowing situations. Most of the time, you know, we're just trying to get through life. So I think it comes down to this question. For anyone who wants to have an objection to this, they have to answer this question: is my life something more than a series of subjective experiences? And if you say it is, then what precisely is it, and what is it that's lost if you move to semi-reality? And if your life isn't anything more than a series of objective experiences, why would anyone ever choose a limited set of possible experiences over an unlimited one? It seems to me that those are the final answers to any way anybody wants to phrase the objections to semi-reality.
Well, no. I don't think we'll even need.
Go ahead.
I don't think we'll even need to go as far as altering ourselves to forget that we're in the simulation, because in the primitive virtual reality I've experienced, just playing Halo 3, I've experienced increased heart rate and I've really immersed myself in the game. There used to be a playlist on Halo 3 in which it was one-on-one, and I found that that was the most intense. Like, when I'm playing with a team, it's like, okay, well, you know, you can just die and the teammate will take care of it. But there was a particular intensity to this playlist because you knew that you were on your own, and if you died too many times, you essentially weren't going to come back because you were all you had. And that was a very compelling experience for me, and I was even sweating, and as I said, my heart rate accelerated. Some people don't get into games as much as that, but there was a Marine who tried the Oculus Rift plus Virtuix Omni combination, and he started shaking reportedly, and he had to leave the simulator because he had been in combat and he was a hardened soldier, and the combat experience of, I think, Half-Life 2 in the Oculus Omni system was too intense, so he had to leave. So I think we'll have some really, really intense experiences in VR and SR.
I think you're right. I'm completely convinced. Unlike the Transporter, which I still have reservations about, I'm ready to sign up with Simuality as soon as it's available. And Stephen, I think you're probably in the same position. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, the steps that get us there, I want to be a part of that as well. Each step of virtual and augmented reality that we take, getting us to that, seems like it's going to increase our abilities to do good things in this world. So I'm all about it.
There you go. All right. Well, I see that Sally is giving us the high sign from the chat room. So with that, we're going to have to wrap it up. Aurelian, I can't tell you how much we enjoyed speaking with you this evening. Thank you so much for being with us, and let's plan on having you back on sometime to talk about these issues further.
Certainly, and I appreciate you inviting me on.
All right, well, thank you so much. Stephen, what's our music that we're going to get a brief sample of this evening?
Now, our music this evening is Secret by Brian Sharp.
Brian Sharp singing Secret. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. We will be on our normal time next week with the much awaited, much anticipated show about radical abundance. Hope you will all be able to be with us. And until next time, live to see it.
Sometimes I feel the difference between your feelings and your words. Other times I feel your defense from your scars, from your burns. But if there's an easy answer, would you tell me what to say? You could be a believer. Would you come outside and play? 'Cause I have a secret that I'm much too scared to tell. I found an angel buried deep.
witness to the Lord.